From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Azar Nafisi first began writing her new book when she was just finishing up her very popular book, Reading Lolita in Tehran. She says it occurred to her that she didn't want people to believe books were meaningful just because they'd been censored by repressive regimes. She says she wanted people to know they were vital here, too, in a place where freedom of expression is taken for granted. She came to realize the characters in the books of fiction she read were vital to American democracy. But she's worried the ideas in those books are being threatened here, too. Nafisi has conceived of what she calls a republic of imagination, where people read to understand and live the American dream. And today she's joining us to talk about it. To make her case, she chose three books in particular, America in Three Books, after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Azar Nafisi is joining us to talk about the state of literature and the humanities in the United States. Many of you know Nafisi from her very popular book, Reading Lolita in Tehran. Her latest takes on some of the classics, of American literature, three books in particular, to help her make a case for what she calls the Republic of Imagination. Nafisi is worried about what she sees as a growing lack of respect for ideas and the imagination, and she says fiction is vital to American democracy, and imaginative knowledge is pragmatic. She says it helps us shape our attitude to the world and our place in it. Politicians, she says, or businessmen or teachers are all affected by this vision or its lack. The book is called The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. And you can join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Azar Nafisi is a scholar and a writer whose books include the memoir, as I mentioned, Reading Lolita in Tehran. She's written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, as well as many others. She's joining us from NPR in Washington. And Azar Nafisi, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I wanted to begin in Seattle a few years ago, as you write about in your book, this encounter that you have with a young man in a bookstore there, because that, in some ways, is where a lot of this began. Could you tell us that story?
Yes, I was there in Seattle in 2004, I believe, or 2003, giving a talk and signing books for Reading Lolita in Tehran. And in the queue for the book signing, there was this very somber young man, an Iranian man. And when he came close to, you know, it was his turn to have his book signed, he told me that he has no book, but he wanted to tell me something. And he said very passionately and seriously that it's no use. You're wasting your time. They, meaning the American people, they're not interested in books and such things. They're not like us who would Xerox hundreds of pages of Madame Bovary or Huckleberry Finn to read. And that very much stayed with me, the fact that how true that statement was. And the relationship between those who, like that young man, come from a repressed and repressive society and find the openings in books, and those who live in more open and democratic societies.
Did you think he was right? I mean, do you think he was right? Because you say that he was right, and in some ways you think he wasn't.
Yes, I think he was right and he wasn't right.
Yeah.
And that was based, to tell you the truth, that's what's based on my own experiences when I returned to America in 1997. I discovered two parallel things going on at the same time. One was the fact that there was a denigration of imagination and ideas, and the best way to gauge that was, of course, in our education, that as years went by and as years are going by, our policymakers are putting the pressure on public schools and the first things that go are art, music, poetry, and now through our Common Core standards, we're also reducing the amount of fiction our children read, cutting funding for libraries, cutting funding for museums, under the guise of the fact that we're living in a time of financial crisis. And I remember a far bigger financial crisis. I mean, I don't remember because I wasn't alive then, but I have studied it and written a dissertation on the 1930s, the Depression of 1930s, when writing and music and art were very much part of the effort to get the economy going, to give people hope and meaning at a time when hope and meaning were being taken away from them. And one of the things the government did was create the writers' projects and the art projects, and so many things came from them. They didn't give writers and artists money, which wasn't the reason for them to work, to write and create, but they gave them respect and they made them feel to be part of the society and part of the society that will change the crisis they were undergoing.
We should say that even though you didn't really get his name, he kind of wandered off into the bookshelves, I suppose. But you gave him a name, Ramin. And I guess, is it fair to say he became kind of a companion in some ways throughout this book? You kept going back to him in your
yes.
mind.
Yes, you know, he became a kind of a companion. It is really amazing how people who have been connected to you and whom you know, but also people whom you might, you know, meet only once in your life. As a writer, they become your imaginary companions. I used to have imaginary friends when I was a child, but I need conversation. I need conversation both with people who are real and with people who have a passing physical presence in my life, but an enduring influence. And Ramin also reminded me of the fact of the other side of the coin to the American experience, which was the fact that for the past 11 years, I have been traveling at least 33 states, including Utah, and I've, states that are called red or blue, people coming from all sorts of backgrounds and different ideologies and beliefs. And yet I have seen such passion among those people for knowledge, for having meaning and passion in their lives and not just money and a vocation, for also seeing their democracy in crisis and wanting to do something about it. And that is why I mention in my book that I wanted to write this book for those interlocutors like Ramin and the readers whom I call intimate strangers, because they're both, I might not know them personally, but I feel as if we know one another through other means.
You say from time to time when you travel, you would get, particularly when I guess you were traveling with Lolita, the in Tehran book, that you would get some version of this question. Do you think literature and books were so important for you when you were in Iran because of the repression in that country? But you don't really agree with that, not entirely.
No, I don't agree with that at all, actually. And sometimes even my own students might ask me, or not in this way, but they would say, why should we read Huck Finn? Or why should we read The Great Gatsby? We read it in high school. Or, you know, what does that have to do with the price of peaches in Georgia, you know, right, with what I'm doing right now? And you know, the posing of the question itself sounded a little bit strange to me. It seemed as if what they were telling me was that those people who didn't have access to the books should be reading the books because, you know, they might get killed for it. But we who have access to the books, we who can go to the bookstores and, you know, order on Amazon or, you know, go to the libraries, if we have access to them, why should we read them? Would the response to them be that, let's censor you guys and make you interested in reading? The whole point about it, what was being missed in the question, was the fact that people have told stories throughout the ages, since since the dawn of man, that all our ideas about the world and our relationship to the world comes from the telling of the stories. Look at the Greek and Roman mythologies. Look at the stories in Bible and Torah and Quran. We still watch the plays of Aeschylus because man needs essentially to be telling stories and to be listening to stories. So democracies need them as well. The second thing is that novels, specifically fiction, is a product of democracy because structurally it is based on those values and principles that a democratic nation should guard in order to survive. And that is the multivocality, giving voice to different characters, trying to understand others, even your enemies, rather than just dismissing them, the idea of individual choice. All of that our children learn through stories and later through novels. So, and look at all these great novelists. Was Margaret Atwood or I don't know, Toni Morrison or Jonathan Franzen, were these people all tortured? That is why they write and that is why people read them? Definitely not. Mm-hmm. Definitely not.
What Ramin was getting at was that, as you point out early in the book, Americans didn't understand their own literature, as if you write Western literature was for people someplace else, like in Iran. It was meaningful for you there. But was Ramin right about that in the sense that we're not reading fiction to understand ourselves?
Yes, I think that is a symptom and a very serious symptom of a far deeper malady where our society has now become so divided over ideology. Ideology and this sort of superficial political divisions are very dangerous because they make us feel very complacent and comfortable. We feel maybe we are radical and we're constantly fighting against an enemy. But the point that we feel self-righteous on the right side, always. And we don't even bother to listen to the kind of news that might differ with our ideology or mindset. That is very complacent. And our society is moving more and more away from difficulties, away from obstacles, away from the kind of obstacles that imagination and thought put in front of us because we have to question ourselves and not just the other. We have to be held responsible. And we're moving towards a mindless, entertaining, comfortable world. On one hand, Kim Kardashian and reality shows, just to be very brief. And then an ideological world where things are only black and white. Look at the way we're looking at NRA, for example, and the gun question. That is why Americans are, getting away, being taken away. I don't think all Americans do that.
No.
I think many don't. From real ideas and from real creativity.
It's interesting. At some point, this really became an obsession for you.
Yes.
You talk about how you were writing down, you had this notebook with you and you were writing down statements constantly and reading magazines and watching television and looking at, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and Fox News and all of this stuff. And you were writing down things, you say, that you hadn't really thought about that much in the past, in income inequality, upward mobility, all of these kinds of things. So at what point, when you're fretting about all of this, did you start to make the connection between that and fiction? Or do you think you always understood that as a connection?
I think that partly unconsciously I always understood it, and I learned it the hard way when I went back to Iran, when I realized that one of the first things, the first things any totalitarian system erases and attacks are individual rights and human rights, and the first victims become women, minorities, and culture. So alongside of taking away rights from women and minorities, their first target of attacks were writers and journalists and poets, they didn't put engineers in jail unless the engineers were protesting, you know. Right. But they knew that those who produced thought and imagination were their sworn enemy. They were their natural enemy, and they are still the main target of attacks. So I realized that this reality that I want to change is very, very much related to the world of ideas and imagination. And I need to defend my turf in terms of ideas and imagination in order to be able to defend my turf in reality. Right. And I discovered the same thing in America. I decided that the denigration of imagination and thought in America came from denigration of what is essential to imagination and thought, which is curiosity and empathy. And that is why we send our children to private schools as members of Congress or as some members of the administration, but we do not have the same kind of standards for our public schools. This is just one example. Sure. I could bring you many.
Well, we'll get to some of those because I think it's interesting. You have some very particular concerns. It's interesting, three books, America and three books, and we'll talk about the three, but it's so much more than three books and so much more than just three writers. And we have to mention, as you do early on, very eloquently, your first, as you put it, fictional journey to America in the wonderful Wizard of Oz, which an English tutor introduced to you. Would you talk about that? Because you spent some time in the introduction writing about that beautifully. It really mesmerized you, this story, and I guess it gave you a sense of the idea of home. It's more than that, but would you talk about that?
Yes, actually, I'm glad you brought this up. Maybe we should change the subtitle for this book, actually, because you're right. I talk about more books, and I begin and end this book with two very, very important and vital books to me. One is the one you mentioned, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, and the other one is, of course, James Baldwin and his work, which I think is essential for us, especially today. But going back to that question about The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, you're right. It was my first experience with the imaginary map of America. And so the first time I imagined America, I imagined Kansas. You know? And I was just in Kansas and telling them about the fact that, you know, I realized that at the heart of a place that was described as sort of a desert, you know, with no trees, no greenery, there can be a cyclone. And at the heart of that cyclone, there can be this green, wonderful land of Oz. And I learned something about the American dream, about what I would come to love about America through its restless, homeless, orphaned characters like Dorothy and later on Huck Finn and others. And that was the fact that Dorothy goes on this journey, and in the book, unlike the film, it's not a dream. They don't say that she was dreaming.
Right.
She goes through this journey and she finds these friends who are each finding what they find lacking. And for Dorothy, her home is important, although her home is far bleaker, far more difficult to live in than that wonderful land of Oz, which is unlike what we want. We always want that world of comfort and entertainment and illusion, but she wants the real thing, which is very important to me. And the last thing I wanted to say about this was this idea of individualism and of the growth of the individual, which you have also in Huck Finn, through going through trial and error and proving yourself and finding out in the end that it is not the wizard who is going to give you your freedom, your home, your heart, your mind, but it is going to be you yourself. So self-dependence comes from within the individual experience and from individual connecting to the world outside and discovering the strength within. That was a great lesson about what it meant to be an American.
One of the things you asked yourself, you say, before you became a citizen, which you did in December of 2008, was this question. What transforms a country from a place, you know, you live in as a refuge to a place that you call home? And the big change for you, you say, was when you feel like you can start complaining about it and wanting to change it. This was important too, I guess.
Yes, it was, and especially because nowadays, especially with our two parties, one party keeps talking about America, patriotism, and you know, defines this as just no criticism, and the other party is mute. we don't know what kind of America they want to be, you know. So, yeah. And I felt that, okay, each American citizen has to ask for themselves, you know, what kind of America American do I want to be? And especially one who this time is choosing a home, like me. I have no excuse. And I wanted to define what kind of America, because I knew if I didn't, someone else would define it for me. And for me, the idea of home is not by just constantly praising home, but finding that the things that are wrong with home bother you, that you want to change it because you care. If I come to Utah, if I, you know, I look at the state, I say, gorgeous state, you know, I love to go skiing, and I go home. Or I say, no, Washington, D.C. has got, you know, better, I don't know what better.
There's Ethiopian restaurants or whatever, right?
Restaurants, and yeah. We have the Smithsonian, yeah. So I want to go back to Washington. Yeah. But if I make Utah my home from day one, I want to change it. I want to make it better.
Yeah.
I care about how I feel about it and other people feel about it. And when I started complaining about why are things like this in this country, I decided I should become an American, or maybe I'm already an American and don't know it, you know, and I want to change.
Yeah.
And I want to just say one last thing. I take my lessons from the two great writers I talk about, Mark Twain and James Baldwin, yeah. About patriotism. Mark Twain says, patriotism is supporting your country all of the time and the government when it deserves it. And Baldwin says something very similar. He says, I love America more than any other country in the world, and that is why I give myself the right to criticize it.
Right.
You know.
I want to come back to James Baldwin, which we'll come to in the end, because it's such a, I think, an important part of this story. Let me ask you this before we head into a break, though. When did you come up with the idea, the term, Republic of Imagination?
I think almost since time immemorial, but it started after I finished reading Lolita in Tehran, yeah. And I was going to Italy and giving a talk there, and I thought, why would Italian people love my book? It's about Iran, and it's about these English-speaking authors, and Italian people loved my book, which was really amazing. You know, it became one of the places where I became bestseller all the time,
yeah.
And I realized, and through the speech I gave there, which became the basis for this book, was the fact that before I came to Italy, I had entered the imaginary map of Italy. And this had happened with me every country I went before that. I had been to its imaginary country through the stories and through its films and art. And so I came back from Italy, and I published this article in Washington Post in December of 2004 called The Republic of Imagination, because that is the only republic, the portable world, in which I feel safe, in which no one can take away from me.
Azar Nafisi is with us. Her new book is The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. We need to take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Azar Nafisi. We're talking about her new book. It's called The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. In it, she argues the greatest danger to the literary arts is not a totalitarian regime, but the intellectual indolence of the public. One of the things that you identify is this kind of inherent contradiction in the heart of American democracy is, on one hand, this desire for newness. Mm-hmm. The rejection of old ties, as you say, as kind of a precondition for equality and wealth. This idea that, and this is part of the problem, I guess, that the sense that in some ways the dream is already fulfilled, that's, you see, as
yes.
a problem.
Yes. And, you know, before going into that, may I do something that I shouldn't? Maybe I wanted to say that I just wrote down KUER address so that I can text it and make my first donation.
Okay.
And that one reason I wrote this book was to support our public spaces that are so dear to us, like NPR and PBS. So just wanted to tell
Good.
You.
Glad you said that.
And your audience
Thank
that
you.
I'm joining them
Good.
In doing that. What you said about the American dream and for the desire for newness, yes, I think that usually our strength, if we're not careful, at some point can become our weakness. Mm. Because America was new. It didn't have all those traditions in Europe. And it became the master of innovation. So many of the innovations in the modern world begin with this country. But at the same time, at some point, new wealth is not new wealth anymore. You know, an accumulation of wealth creates a class that could be as predatory and as insidious as the class that the traditionalists in Europe, the monarchists in Europe, from which America declared its independence. And that is why the country goes through constant crisis, because we need to open this society to everyone. And I think that this is one of the periods of transition where the problem is not that people are making money. I do understand that you need to make money and you need to create jobs for everyone. But what I'm worried about is this accumulation of wealth in the hand of this, really the 1%, and the sort of gradual and now speeded up weakening of middle classes and lack of upward mobility. These are the things that someone who used to be so illiterate about these issues is now becoming concerned. And that is why we need empathy and curiosity. That was the drive behind our universities, behind our research. Research for both science and literature are being cut. More and more our universities and our places of learning, including our think tanks, like Brookings even, are becoming dependent on corporate money and on foreign governments' money. You know, and these are very dangerous signs. Yeah. Knowledge should have its own independence, and it should be free of politics and free of money. We should just remember the way George Washington and Benjamin Franklin and the founders looked at these issues.
American history is an important element here in this story, and it comes from a little bit of goading or prodding from your friend Farah. Let's talk about that, because this first, you begin with Twain, end with, yes, Baldwin. Let's start with Huckleberry Finn then. Your friend Farah, as I mentioned, best friend from childhood. Mm-hmm. She survived a revolution, a war, crossed the border from Iran to Turkey when she was 7 months pregnant. It's a pretty amazing story. Mm-hmm. Would you talk about her and the affinity that you felt with her? Because it's interesting, you describe it as, in the book, is belonging to two languages. This is the mm-hmm. thing that you shared. Talk about that affinity and your connection, and because this gets us to Huck Finn, I think.
Yes, Farah. And you know, Farah, my friend, unfortunately, she died of cancer. And before she died, she would always tease me that you never put me in your books. Right. You know, and I had put her in my books, but the place was wrong. And it is so amazing that she came to me after she herself was gone. But the whole point about Farah was that we were childhood friends and we were relatives, and so we were very, very close. But what made this friendship very unique was that we literally did belong to two worlds. First of all, in both our families, there was this instinct for rebellion towards power, mm-hmm. which got both of us into trouble when we both came to America separately and got involved in the student movement. Farah's grandmother, at her own time, converted to Baha'ism, which is an off-branch of Islam, which is treated, especially right now by the clerics, the way the Jews were treated in Nazi Germany. Baha'is are, you know, heretics. Mm-hmm. And she joined that religion, you know, at the beginning of last century. And so anyway, another thing that we had very much in common was that we both left Iran at a young age, and we both actually majored in English Lit. Right. We both majored in literature. We were both politically active. And both Persian and literature and language and culture became our two portable homes. And when we were both exiled and met again after decades in Washington, D.C., that sort of fragile reality that we both experienced and enduring culture of literature and arts made us especially close to one another.
I wanted to ask you about what you call Mark Twain's act of heresy. His recognition of the mongrel quality of the American identity on one hand, but there's also what you call, in fact, his most effective act of heresy was his literary declaration of independence. He was writing books in a different way. That's important, too.
Yes. And I think that with every great social upheaval and change is sometimes preceded, but sometimes accompanied by great change in culture and especially in fiction. And Mark Twain, as many, including Hemingway and Mencken and Fitzgerald have mentioned, he was the first who decided that, you know, he will start completely anew, because all our great writers before that still use the language that came from the mother country, namely Britain. But Mark Twain was declaring his literary independence from quote-unquote old Europe, and at the same time from the sort of the new guardians of New America. Whom he called the Mayflower tribe, right. and he in one address, he tongue in cheek, he tells them that you deprived me of my ancestry, beginning with the American, Native Americans through Quakers, the witches, and ending with the slaves. And he says that, for I am a many shaded, exquisite mongrel. I love that. I think this is so fantastic. And so he went on in Huck Finn to create his exquisite mongrels. And he subverted not just the culture of Europe. He wasn't addressing Europe anymore. He was addressing this new America, the Gilded Age America. And he was saying to them that you are bringing civilization here, and alongside of it, when you bring conformity, when you bring the Sunday school mentality, when you have the evil of slavery at the heart of your society, then nobody will feel safe here. That is why Huck and Jim are safest when they are in wilderness, and they are most in danger when they go to those smothery houses, which represents civilization to them. He changed the language. Nowhere in the world do we have a Huck and Jim, their language, their perspective, and their landscape. And it changed the course of American fiction forever and ever.
There's that remarkable moment in the book, of course, where Huck has decided whether to turn Jim in.
Yes.
And it's such an important symbol for, you say, you and this country, because Huck decides against it, of course. And this is when he decides that he is wicked, and that he will remain true to his wickedness. You write that Huck then really turns the civilized world on its head. Talk about that, because that's a really important idea.
He does. And I wanted to talk about that because of the kind of morality we hear about in terms of American individualism nowadays, which is very almost vicious, you know, all for myself, nothing for the others, no thinking behind it, just success and money. But with Huck, he becomes a whole human being through the eyes of Jim. He has to connect to Jim. At first, he's alone and he's still a child. But when he decides to pretend to be dead, he's resurrected through the eyes of Jim. And Jim teaches Huck how to become an individual through creating a moral compass for him. When he makes fun of Jim or plays tricks on him, he realizes how wrong he is. And he says, I felt so bad that I felt like kissing his feet, you know. And then when he decides, he believes that he will go to hell if he doesn't give Jim up. But he follows his wicked heart, because he still doesn't understand that he's not wicked. You know, he's a child, and he still is racist in terms of the language he uses, but he is a moralist in terms of following his heart and deciding to go to hell, but not to give Jim up. And that says a great deal about human relations and human empathy, and that we cannot live on ourselves on ourselves alone. We always need the alternative eyes of the others.
Let's talk about Babbitt, of course, written by Sinclair Lewis. And you say you think of Lewis as, in some way, the real-life model for the adult Huckleberry Finn. This thing, something I hadn't realized. He's such an interesting man, Sinclair Lewis. When he died, he left almost no personal possessions.
Yeah.
Does that tell you?
Yeah, and you know, you bring up a very, very central point about these American heroes, actually. Because for them, especially for Huck, who says money is not what it was made out to be, mm-hmm. for them, wealth means nothing. For them, doing the right thing and finding the right thing means a lot. And Sinclair Lewis, from the very start, partly because of his looks and partly because of his temperament, was always alone, almost like an outcast. And he dies alone in Italy and not in his own homeland. And when he dies, there is so little left of him. There's his glasses and his tennis rackets and his suitcase, you know. These are what they put in auction because Sinclair Lewis had no possessions. Yeah. The possessions he has is the portable world of his writings,
right.
You know. And he always felt insecure among those who were secure, despite the fact that he was the first American to win the Nobel Prize for Literature.
It's funny, George Babbitt, a character, you say, unlike Huckleberry Finn in every way, but still every bit as iconically American. In what way?
Yes, that is why I was choosing these novels, because I feel each of these novelists create a new language for a new character. And definitely, Sinclair Lewis created a new language and a new landscape for this anti-Huck character, which is the other side of the American society. It is those conformists. The radical lawyer in Babbitt says that what he's scared about America is standardization of thought.
Yeah.
And that is what Babbitt represents. But I wanted to remind us, because when I read Babbitt this time, before when I read it as a student, I was laughing at him. And then when I read it this time, the horrible discovery was that how much of a Babbitt I have in me. I mean, all of us who line up in front of a Nike store or an Apple store waiting for our new gadgets to play with cannot laugh at gadgets Babbitt worships in his world. And the other aspect of it, which I found very important, was that Sinclair Lewis does not demonize Babbitt. He reminds us that Babbitt also dreams, and he also feels restless at his heart, and he knows that he has failed in some very essential way, although he joins the crowd. And I think that that is very important in novel, that we go under the skin of the character.
But you make this connection in this part of the book to this creeping Babbitt-like mentality that you see in these Common Core educational standards.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that, because you say that there's a kind of an eagerness to create this efficient and productive standardized student, I guess. No time for the imaginative knowledge in this standardized view.
Yes, because you deprive everything that has life of its essence. Like in the book, I talk about the way they were prescribing to teach the Gettysburg Address, one of the most poetic, lyrical, humane speeches in the history of politics anywhere in the world, you know? And the first thing that they do, they say that they instruct the teachers to deprive it of its context, to have the students not talk about funerals or the occasion for the Gettysburg Address. So they read it without knowing that they had such amazingly exceptional individuals in the history of their country, and that how much Lincoln, for creating this language and the speech that he wrote, he depended on Shakespeare, Bible, and Milton. You know, so why should they students, after they go through this sort of a thing, which makes them, as the creators of Common Core standards talk about, career ready and vocation ready, why should the students really care about America if they don't know anything about, really about, if they don't feel its history, if they don't feel its cultures, if they don't understand what Huck stands for, and if they do not connect, if they don't go to study because they're passionate, because they want meaning, they only go to study to become, I don't know, either a teacher or of course, teachers are not, is not a very good vocation these days, or an engineer. Why should an engineer go to war for America, if he has no affiliation to its history, to its context, to its culture? This is a very slippery road. And we should remember that China, which we're praising because of its mathematics, has now discovered that they have reached the dead end because of the fact that in China, they do not have liberal arts. They are trying to promote liberal arts in China, which comes into contradiction with the regime. Mm-hmm. Actually, Diane Ravitch, a great critique of the Common Core standards, has an article about this in the new issue of New York Review of Books about education in China. Mm-hmm.
Before we head to a break, I want to say one more thing about Babbitt. And that's, you write about the end where he gives up the fight, says, I've never done a single thing I wanted to in my whole life. But you point out, and this is a big theme in the book, few American novels have happy endings, but there's often what you call a glimmer of hope. And that glimmer of hope is important to you. Say something about that.
Yes, because the great American novels are very realistic, in fact. You know, they take their cue from life. And, mm-hmm. and that is why at the end of Huckleberry Finn, we don't know what will happen to Huck or Jim. But the glimmer of hope is not in the ending. It is in the process. It is the process where the protagonist, and along with the protagonist, the readers come to the realization about they should go to hell, but do the right thing. And with Babbitt, he comes to that consciousness, which he doesn't have at the beginning. He comes to the consciousness that had I been different, had I been like the people that I am bad-mouthing, you know, I would have felt more fulfilled. And that is what we as readers should take away. And that is what makes us as readers hopeful, because through Babbitt, we're gaining the consciousness that he, at the beginning, didn't have.
Azar Nafisi is with us. Her book is called The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. We need to take another quick break. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Azar Nafisi is with us today in the program. Her new book is called The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. I want to read an email that came this morning from Anjali in Ogden. She says, "How do you think about the focus on STEM, science, tech, engineering, and math in America's schools, and how that will affect the future of the humanities and literature?" Anjali says, "I wonder if there might be a counter focus that we could propose." She's proposing HEAP: history, English, literature, art, and philosophy or politics. What do you think?
Wonderful, wonderful idea. Please contact me. That is great. But I want to say something about that as well. You see, this is the problem, that a utilitarian mindset, which is not pragmatic, in fact, separates science and technology from humanities. All we have to do, and I mention it in my book, all we have to do is go, for example, to Steve Jobs, who talks about how much of his success in innovation and in creating Apple dependent on in fact, not only going hungry and going against the flow, but also on humanities. And he talks about how when he dropped school, then he went and took a course in the most useless courses of all, which is calligraphy. And later on, he discovered that calligraphy was good for the logo, the Apple logo. Now we have examples of this throughout. First of all, scientists, the greatest scientists are usually also the greatest humanists. Take Einstein. Walter Isaacson's books on Einstein and Steve Jobs and Walter Isaacson's speeches on these issues are fantastic, actually. And Einstein believed that imagination is even more important than what he calls knowledge, which means scientific knowledge, because he says knowledge is limited, but imagination encircles the world. So we have to know and tell our students that those people who are planning and segregating science and literature from one another, they know neither science nor literature. You know, and that we will have very few innovators in this country if we keep on doing that. And by the way, research for science and for NIH and all those other branches of science are also being cut and non-funded. So independent research is very much unfunded. Nabokov says, who was both a scientist and a writer and poet, he said you need to have the passion of the scientist and the precision of the poet, because science and humanities are twins, and they cannot be separated from one another.
You know, we don't have a whole lot of time, so I'm going to just jump over, and I'm Carson McCullers, and forgive me, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, that's one of the three books, of course, but we have to get to James Baldwin,
yes.
Because
this is... I'm sorry, I'm doing this very slowly.
No, you're great. I just, look, people can read the book, because the Carson McCullers part is terrific. The epilogue about James Baldwin is really extraordinary, and I wanted you to talk about this particular moment, because it's, you contrast this idea of innocence, the idea that J.D. Salinger writes about in The Catcher in the Rye, how Holden Caulfield wanted to preserve the innocence of children, but Baldwin really wants to end that innocence. And that's an important distinction for you. Would you talk about that?
It's a very important distinction for me. And that is why I felt that, not just that, I felt that James Baldwin should have rightly, his first novel, Go Tell It on Mountain, should be considered the great American novel, because it is in many ways. Now, the whole idea of innocence and the way Baldwin looks at it, he looks at it and he says, remember, I'm a preacher's son, and that the first bite of that tree was the tree of knowledge, which is, identified with sin. The whole idea behind innocence can be very dangerous, because it means that as long as you're innocent, you do not witness what is happening in the world and you can keep silent about it. But once you know, then it becomes a crime to remain silent. So people who know become always questioning and restless and subversive, because they have to then, as Baldwin says, become a witness. And I think that that is one of the greatest messages you can give any nation, and it is at the heart of Baldwin's essays and novels. Constant attempt to relieve us of innocence and force us to bite the apple.
You know, Baldwin, he makes a name for himself with Go Tell It on the Mountain. But then his next book he wants to publish, Giovanni's Room, about a young white man and his gay love affair. Now, if you put that in the context of the time, here is a black man writing about homosexuality, and he was advised by pretty much everyone, that is a terrible idea. You're going to ruin your career. But he wouldn't have it. He stuck with the idea.
That is... You pointed out the two most important things about Baldwin. That is another thing that he refused. You know, his agent told him, burn the book.
You know,
but the whole point about it was that, and he says, I'm neither a Negro writer, he said, nor a gay writer. I'm a writer. You see, the way we respect people is not to peg them, as he himself actually uses the word peg, and categorize them and say that, for example, I had this experience when I came here here, everybody was, not everybody, but many in the academia were saying, if you're a woman and come from a Muslim society, then you have to only be talking about that. And I was saying that you go and talk about that. I want to talk about dead white males, you know, because of the whole idea of literature, of thought, is about the other, that you shouldn't constantly be talking about yourself, but about yourself in relation to those who are not you. And so it's not just African-Americans who should be reading Baldwin. He doesn't just belong to gays or African-Americans. He doesn't even belong only to Americans. He belongs to the world. And he went out to the world. He went to spent most of his adult life in France and died in France. And he spent a great deal of his time in Turkey because he belongs to the world, although his roots are in America. Mm-hmm. And he went out to the world in order to understand America. This universality that you see in every aspect of Baldwin's work, including his fight for civil rights, is something that we have a lot to learn from in this age of political correctness.
That age of political correctness brings us back around to something that you worry about a lot, of course. And that is, we're starting to see, you point out, how students from different colleges are requesting now that classic works of fiction be labeled. And there's something that you write about from a story in the New York Times about Oberlin College. This guide said that they should flag anything that might, quote, disrupt a student's learning and cause trauma, you know, to beware of racism and classism and sexism and heterosexism and cissexism and ableism and all these other kinds of things. Would you say something about that finally? Because this is what you really are worried about.
You know, first of all, disturbing the learning. I think they should read Mark Twain when he says that education is about and learning.
Right.
Everything, first of all. And second of all, you go to especially a great college like Oberlin in order to be disturbed.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that knowledge, nobody should go to a university and nobody should teach or create a university if they don't want to be disturbed. Because that is where you question everything, and including yourself. And that is the need for our students, is that to face their pain, not to escape away from it. One of the greatest things about Americans was that when they were traumatized, if you're raped in your childhood, then you create an organization and you create a platform for all of those who are raped to come and talk and stand up to the demon and get rid of it, not to escape from it. You know, and that is one of the things that really bothers me, or people just jumping at one another and in a superficial manner policing one another, where we reach a point where you have feminists attacking Mark Zuckerberg because he says that he doesn't like to dress fancy, he likes to wear T-shirts, and they say that you are insulting women. Because you're saying that women like fashion, so they're superficial. No, there are all sorts of women. Some women don't like fashion. Some women like fashion. You know, and some men are like Mike Zuckerberg. Others like to wear Armanis, you know. Why are you making a big deal out of everything that is so insignificant? You know, and this is becoming a very insignificant culture. Feminism has racism. These are great struggles this country has gone through. People like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Harriet Beecher Stowe gave their lives to gain these rights. In the 70s, it was all about, we women are so independent, we don't become insulted all the time by insignificant remarks and things. You know, so yes, I am very worried. And the culture that keeps eulogizing a girl like Malala, giving her the Nobel Prize, should learn something from Malala. And the fact is that this girl, every time she comes on stage, she's traumatized because she's reliving that moment where she was shot in the head in order to read the kind of books that we have here for free. So our students should get up and remember where their grandmothers came from, you know.
Zahra Nafisi, the book is The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. She joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Annie Lane Clark, and Michael Shea today. I'm Doug Fabrizio.